all work done in service to the Lord is a calling, is a vocation, and there is no secular or sacred divide between, you know, what is a a holier calling and a less holy calling.
Karen Swallow Pryor is the author of several books, among them The Evangelical Imagination, On Reading Well, Finding the Good Life Through Great Books, and Fierce Convictions, The Extraordinary Life of Hannah Moore. A prominent voice in the Christian public sphere, she's a frequent speaker, a senior fellow at the Trinity Forum, and a contributing writer to the Dispatch, and a monthly columnist at Religion News Service. Karen and I talked today about her most recent book titled You Have a Calling, Finding Your Vocation in the True, Good, and Beautiful. I'm Matthew Wickman of the BYU Faith and Imagination Institute. Okay, so Karen Swallow Pryor, I've been wanting to have you on the podcast for quite some time now. Several months ago, I saw you post on social media that you were writing a book on callings. And so people in my faith community talk about callings in terms of specific, like church assignments. But you meant callings in a more expansive sense of vocation, right? A sense of being called for some purpose. And when I saw that you were writing that book, I thought, okay, now that's a subject about which I'd love to talk with Karen Swallow Pryor. So I know this is not your first podcast. You've done on this book, done several others. But nonetheless, thank you for coming on here and talking with me about this topic and about your book.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm delighted.
So I got to start with an obvious question. Okay, so why this book and why now? If I can put it this way, do you feel like you were called to write this book? And if so, why do you think that is? And if you weren't called to write it in particular, why bother?
You know, I've done a lot of interviews on this book and this topic by this point, but no one's actually asked me that question.
Really?
And it's beautiful, right? Did I feel called to write this book? And the answer is yes, because the sort of immediate origins of the book were being called or emailed or asked to write a talk, to give a talk on the creative calling, which I did that. It was at a small conference put on by the Rabbit Room, which is a creative kind of collective. And then I gave the talk a couple of times, and as I kept giving it, I expanded into being more about all callings in general, and creativity is part of it, but it sort of evolved from there. But the response to the talks that I gave about calling at all stages of life and ordinary callings, the response was just so enthusiastic. There seemed to be such a hunger for it, which was interesting because there are just so many books on calling and on vocation. I mean, I had to read half of them in research for my book. So it's not as though they aren't out there, but I think it's a topic. A lot of the books are, you know, several, you know, years, if not decades old, and we live in a particular cultural moment that has its own particular distortions and excesses and needs. And so I realize that there is a need now to talk about calling in a way that hits our cultural moment right now.
Yeah, good. I thought that the book speaks to that moment very well. There's a clear and easy communication about it that does seem resonant with the kinds of questions that people have about this topic. I really appreciated the way you began the book. You posed these questions at the beginning of the book, right? You ask questions like, for example, I'm quoting here, how do you know what your calling is? How can you be sure of it when it comes? And how do you know when a calling ends? And I've got to admit, I was especially taken with that last question, right? So the question of vocation, it's important for young adults because they're trying to figure out their life path. But that last question about how you know when a calling ends, that's a question for adults, right? I say this because, you know, the end of a calling may involve a process of learning to let go of something and experience some grief about letting go, et cetera. I found that question to be especially profound.
Well, of course, I think it's obvious if you read this book that I am drawing a great deal on the years that I had with college students. And a lot of the questions I'm addressing are geared toward them and that particular stage in life. At the same time, I really wanted to write a book that would address all stages of life, including my own, which is much later than the college students that I'm dealing with. And so, I mean, beginning with my definition of callings, of which we can get into more later if you want, but that callings are something that come from outside of ourselves. It's an invitation. And as Christians, we would believe that ultimately that invitation is a divine invitation. It comes from God, even through people. That also means that it's not just entirely our choice. It's not just entirely something that we choose to do, although of course we do choose to answer the call or not. And that callings are not limited to our work and our profession, our careers. They include our family roles and our citizenship and being neighbors and these kinds of things. And so there are many callings, I mean, hopefully not many over the course of one life, that can end. And again, that can include our jobs and our working lives, but it also includes, for example, if a spouse dies, then our calling to be that person's spouse has ended. If, you know, if a loved one dies, then your calling to be perhaps a son or a daughter ends. And so there are different kinds of deaths that we can experience in life, literally, but that also entail the death of a calling. And yes, grief is very much involved.
Yeah, I really appreciated that when I read that. Just today in a class I was teaching, actually, we were reading an essay by someone, a scholar of spirituality named Janet Ruffing, talks about building a narrative identity in a spiritual sense, a spiritual identity through the stories that we tell about ourselves. And she talked about building it, being open to God, but God enters. It's not someone that just gives us what we want or expect. God often enters as a disruption. Right, so that many callings don't come to us as our first choice, right? God's confirming that you wanted it, you've got it. It's rather, you know, well, hold on a second. This may not be what you had in mind. Or if the calling's going to end, sometimes that can also be experienced as a disruption, right, before you find the next phase of your life.
I think that's a really helpful word because, of course, there are people who feel a sense of calling that early in life that turns out to be their calling. That does happen, but just as often, if not more often, what we are called to is through a disruption. And when that calling ends, it of course can feel like a disruption. And that's the part where the divine enters in. It's not just our choice. It's not just the plans that we make. It's actually the Lord directing our steps.
Which I love. Yeah, so let me go on here. The introduction, again, you supplement that first set of questions with another set that also suggests an adult's perspective here. Right? I'm quoting you again here. You write this. What if your calling takes different forms over the course of your life, changing in shape, color, and size, in the way an oak slowly grows from sapling to mighty timber, slipping each season from gold to green to brown to bare, all while remaining an oak? It's a lovely image. This kind of perspective seems to require that we can recognize divine patterns, right? Kind of the pattern of how God works in our individual lives. Was that right? Would you say yes?
Absolutely, because again, using that oak imagery, I mean, an acorn really doesn't look anything like a grown oak, which doesn't look anything like a sapling, and yet it is the same thing. And so recognizing that the way things look in our lives or the way they play out or manifest can be very different from what we think they should look like or expected that they would look like or how they looked like last year or 10 years ago. And yet there can be this sort of constant within. And yes, there is a pattern, a divine pattern that we have to discern by looking beneath the surface to see what's underneath. And so that can mean sometimes that we might see a calling emerge through weaving different threads of our life together. Like we can see how things came together one way, various things, and that points to a calling that we didn't recognize as a calling, or something that we thought was a calling was actually just sort of a support for or a way or path to what ended up being our calling. And so there are patterns, seeing God at work in them helps us to understand what lies beneath the surface.
Okay, great. Now, for many of us, you mentioned that vocation involves work of some kind or another. And this is a good thing, as you point out. I'm quoting you again here. You say, there will always be work to do. God works. He made us as creatures designed to join him in his work here on earth. That's from your book, early chapter of that book. But a calling involves more than just work, right? And you make a further qualifier in which I'd like you to comment. You say this. Rather than looking at our work, we can look through it as we look through a glass window in order to see what God is doing through us for his kingdom. Okay, so my question is, what does that mean to look through our work, and how does one manage to do that? And I guess, how have you managed to do it?
Well, I will try to describe how I've managed to do it, but first, I really need to give credit where credit is due, because that image and that idea did not originate with me. I gained that idea through a poem by George Herbert, a 17th century English poet called The Elixir. And I would like to read it. And I know you're fine with that. And I hope your readers who might not be expecting to hear a 17th century poet will bear with me. And I'll just, I'll just explain that, Herbert was a minister as well as a poet. He was a devotional poet. So his poetry is almost entirely written to God. And the title of the poem, The Elixir, is a metaphor for that sort of magical formula, in this case, something divine, that allows us to, for our work to be transformed into service for God, no matter what kind of work it is. And so that's where that idea comes from. So I'll just read this poem and then I'll try to reflect on some ways that I have seen it in my own callings. Teach me, my God and King, in all things thee to see, and what I do in anything to do it as for thee. Not rudely as a beast to run into an action, but still to make thee prepossessed and give it his perfection. A man that looks on glass on it may stay his eye, or if he pleaseth through it pass and then the heaven espy. All may of thee partake. Nothing can be so mean which with his tincture for thy sake will not grow bright and clean. A servant with this clause makes drudgery divine, who sweeps a room as for thy laws makes that and the action fine. This is the famous stone that turneth all to gold, for that which God doth touch and own cannot for less be told.
Bravo.
Thank you. So we can be sweeping, doing the most menial work, and if we are doing it for the Lord, then it turns to gold, and that is the elixir. And so in my own life, I guess the way that I have seen that is I do love to teach. I love teaching in the classroom. I love teaching literature. And I think that is a worthy vocation and a worthy endeavor. And yet, what makes it so worthy and makes it so good is that God, if and when God uses it to transform lives, right? And it really, it is that turns it into gold. So I can put in my best effort and I can, and do it for him. And that's what makes it good. Because as good and noble as teaching is, we all know teachers or have had teachers or know of teachers who really aren't that good and really aren't doing it as a service. I mean, this is true of all professions. And so some role or occupation or calling that is good and noble can end up being not that good and noble if it's not done for the right reasons. And so I think that's an example. And then perhaps a more mundane example, because, it's easy to feel romantic about something you love to do, like teaching. But, another calling that I have in my life right now, which is not one that I chose or, would want, but my father has been widowed. We lost my mother last year. And so in his old age, I am called to be there more for him in a way that I wasn't before. Obviously, I can't replace my mother, but one thing I am doing is cooking quite a bit for him. And I hate cooking. And I am not good at cooking. But I am learning to do it and do it in a way that, because I'm being called to serve in this way and to help my father in this way. And so I am learning, I'm letting God turn it into gold. And that service is hopefully an elixir.
That's lovely. There's a former leader of my faith community, my faith tradition, Thomas S. Monson. I forget, he got this quote from somebody, but he kind of turned it into his own coinage in a way that whom God calls, he qualifies. So it's a way of saying you may not think you're up to it, including cooking in your case, but that kind of care given to your father is actually, that's really lovely. I really appreciate that. You know, historically, you mentioned this in the book. I thought this was an interesting point in your book, that we can trace a lot of the connection between vocation and work to the emergence of this Protestant work ethic, right? And as you point out, this is an ethic that sought to erase the false distinction between the secular and the sacred in terms of vocation, right? That all good work done, you know, for God's glory, done well, can bring, can glorify the Creator, right? However, you point out, and you have there's a paradox here. I'm quoting you. The same idea has contributed to the erasure of the concept of vocation altogether. That's a provocative idea. How is that the case, Karen?
Ooh, well, that the 900 page answer might be found in Charles Taylor's A Secular Age.
Nice. Because, yeah, there we go. Yeah. Yes.
Yep. But the shorter answer is, I think that, you know, so we go back to the Protestant Reformation, where the reformers claimed the idea of, or reclaimed the idea of vocation and calling, which had been used strictly in a clerical sense within the, you know, the church service was a vocation. So the nuns and the priests and other clerics were those who had vocations and callings, and everyone else just did whatever they did. And the reformers, it's a central tenet of the Protestant Reformation, is that all work done in service to the Lord is a calling, is a vocation, and there is no secular or sacred divide between, you know, what is a holier calling and a less holy calling. And so, you know, a father who changes diapers is fulfilling a calling, and a farmer who harvests the wheat in the field is fulfilling a calling, because all callings, according to the reformers, are the ways that God uses us to serve our neighbor, and that's the purpose of calling. Because God could have, you know, created a world in which everything that we needed was magically done, and we didn't need one another. But he designed it such that we need one another's work in order to live and survive and thrive. And so that's a beautiful thing. It's a wonderful teaching. And so we see throughout history that really influenced the rise of the modern age. The idea that work is noble and ennobling, and so people began to work and improve their lives through work. That's the Protestant work ethic, or the Puritan work ethic. And yet that we've sort of paradoxically, as you mentioned, come to this point in late modernity where, you know, there are a few examples of the diminishment of vocation. One is that people have become kind of, through their work, through working hard and valuing work, have turned it into just a career, right? And become career climbers. Or on the other hand, we have highly valued thinking and intellectual work, and we relegate those who work with their hands to the vocational trades, right? And the other people, it's almost like a reverse, like that's the sacred position, is the intellectual work. And so In some ways, our thinking has just sort of flipped in on itself from the beginning of the Protestant Reformation in our culture. And so I want to sort of reclaim those ideas, have us think about them, and rather than continuing an overcorrection, just finding that moderation in the middle where we do value work, but for its ultimate purpose, which is to serve our neighbors, which includes our family as well. So to just be a career climber and to sacrifice everything else to your career is to not fulfill all the callings that you have in your life, which includes things outside of our paying work.
That was a great distillation of a complicated historical process, but it's right. It's good. I think that's exactly right. I even see traces of that in my own Well, I think of times in my life earlier when the career climbing was seemed all important, and it's easy to lose yourself in that a little bit. And you wait, why am I doing this? Right? What am I actually called to do versus what is possible in my career? So that we're kind of on the topic here of discernment a little bit, like discerning what your calling is and knowing how to pursue it as a calling and not just as something like a career or a sheer mere duty, et cetera. And discernment's important because, as you observe, young people, well, it's true people generally, but young adults in particular are often set up for disappointment when it comes to vocations, right? And you confess, I like this in your book, you were something of what you call a dream squasher for young adults when you taught in college. What is the challenge for young adults? Like, why are they so often disappointed when it comes to finding their vocations?
Yeah, and again, this goes back to what I said earlier about how I was writing this book for a particular cultural moment that we're in. And the cultural moment that we're in does highly affect younger people, but it really affects all of us, which is why, because we're in the same culture. And so one of the distortions that we are seeing in there are a couple that I'll name, but one of them is the idea that our work is going to fulfill all of our needs, right? It's just the ultimate, and especially fulfill our financial needs. And so if we love to do something and we want to do something, it's going to be easy and we're going to make a lot of money at it. That's sort of a distortion that's put out there by social media, TikTokers, influencers, who seem to follow that pattern and make it as though it's the pattern that everyone should follow. So that's one sort of distortion that can only lead to disappointment, because it's just not going to happen for 1 out of 1,000 people that they just do something and overnight become a success and a millionaire. Discerning the false messages and the false images from the true ones is important. And that's I think where my role as the dream squasher came in. And the story that I tell, I mean, not that my life is anything, to write home about. It's not something that's exciting and dramatic. I just happen to have become, a successful academic and a fairly successful writer and a very modest level, but I would have students come to me and say they wanted to be like me. So how can they be like me? And they would just be shocked to learn how many years it took me to get to point A and how much experience and education and investment. And they're just looking at what they see now, but not knowing how much went behind it. So giving that sort of, correction, a reality check, I guess, is one part of eliminating or at least reducing the chance of unnecessary disappointment and disillusionment because of unrealistic expectations. And the other part of discernment comes from, not just the reality check, but also realizing that there really aren't any formulas. We're all unique, and what happens to one person in one situation is not necessarily going to happen again. We all have gifts and callings and abilities and passions and opportunities. And then we have the surrounding place where we live that has particular marketplace and needs and needs that may be filled before you get there. And so all of these variables are floating around. And so we really have to discern by yes, watching emulable, noble role models, but asking mentors and teachers and peers and parents for wisdom and advice and learning kind of how to see which things click and which talents and gifts you have, not only that you're good at, but that the world needs in this particular moment. It's a long process, and it just takes paying attention and not assuming that the one person you see on YouTube doing something is a pattern or a formula that you're going to be able to follow successfully as well.
Yeah, good. That's the thing I really appreciate about your book, right? You talk about there is no magical formula or perfect job waiting, right? And you mentioned that this can be actually really freeing. It frees us to develop different interests, talents, seek a wide range of experiences, and really to invest a kind of a faith that God can use anything that we give to him to work with, right? So I'm wondering how that's proven true in some ways in your own case. So you don't go into detail in this in your book, but you mentioned a couple times to leaving behind one expression or manifestation of your calling in the form of the job you held for many years teaching college. And I'm not asking so much why you left the profession of higher ed behind as much as I'm wondering what you found once you entered this new chapter of life. And in particular, do you think now about skills or understanding that you may have developed over the years, perhaps some things that surprised you that enabled you to find a different iteration of this new chapter of your life?
Yeah, so that question taps into a lot of the things I try to cover in the book. And so, for example, we talked earlier about how callings can end. And sometimes it's just a matter of words too. We might say, well, this calling ended because I term or label this calling X. Well, maybe X ended, but your calling really all along has been Y, and you're still doing Y, right? And so sometimes it's a matter of grappling with the terms, it's semantics. But as I said, sometimes there are callings that do end. I mean, I did end my calling as a full-time academic in the classroom ended, which is something that I invested a great deal of my early life in and spent a great deal of my later life in. And so I do think in one way, being a professor is a calling, and that has ended in a formal way, even though I do, it's so complicated because you can teach part-time and adjunct and all those things, right? But at the same time, if my calling is teaching, then I'm still doing that. I'm doing this, talking on this podcast, trying to explain these ideas. I write, I speak, I do guest teaching. I've got a class tonight that I'm beginning. And so if I think of my calling in that respect as teaching, it hasn't ended. It's just taken a different form. But this experience that I had, without going into all the details, but I think it's helpful, it actually is an example of how we do have multiple callings at the same time. And they can be held in tension, and sometimes they conflict with one another. And so when I decided to leave my academic position, it's because there were ultimately two callings of mine that were in conflict. One was the academic post, and the other was my public voice, my public presence in the public sphere. I was put into a position where I had to choose between one and the other. And I loved both of them. And so I had to choose. And so I chose, did entail a great amount of grief and loss, as we talked about before. But sometimes that just happens. We have to choose between the callings that we have, and we don't want to choose, and maybe we shouldn't even have to choose. I don't think I should have had to choose, but that's happened. And so I made what I hope is the better choice. And so I'm continuing my calling in the role of a teacher. And again, it's an example, I think, of sometimes the things we have to do when we're facing how to juggle all the callings in our lives, because we don't have just one calling. We do have multiple ones, and they can shift, and sometimes they can end.
I'm personally grateful for the choice that you made. I mean, we wouldn't be talking on this podcast if not for that choice. And I think that, look, it's not just that. I think that you have a very clearly a gift for a kind of a speaking about complicated and nuanced things in a very clear, lucid way that is accessible. That, you know this from your own experience, there are a lot of people who can be classroom and conference academics that cannot be public intellectuals at all. That's a very unique kind of a skill, and it's a lot rarer a skill than to be a strictly classroom academic. So I'm glad that you made
Thank
that
you.
Choice personally. I think you certainly leaned into a gift, which I think is great.
Thank you.
So let me go here to something else you mentioned in the book. I think it was, again, a really good point. So callings come from God, ultimately, right? But it isn't always easy to discern what God's trying to tell us. Okay, so as you write, and I'm quoting you here, a calling from God isn't an audible vocalization such as that given by a military commander or an order from a judge given in court. Rather, God uses the things he has made, other people, our circumstances, our gifts, and even our passions to sound that call. It's not, and this is what you said earlier, it's not our job to be called, it's our job to answer the call. Okay, so you provide some examples of ways God has reached, God reaches out to us. I wonder if you can think of a way that God reached out to you that may have been a bit more vivid or memorable for being a little less direct. Okay, so it wasn't a vision given in the nighttime, Karen. It's some other way something made clear to you.
Yeah, well, there is one really formative experience I had as a young adult in church. And I think that I had, don't know if I'd started graduate school or not. I didn't even start graduate school expecting to be a professor. I didn't know what I wanted to do. I just wanted to read literature and write papers about it. And so I think I was in graduate school, maybe just beginning to, maybe perhaps had started teaching, but I wasn't much of a public speaker. I still don't see that as my primary. It's just sort of a side. It comes out of my writing. But my pastor asked me to take a role in speaking out in our community on behalf of an issue. And I had never done anything like that. I was someone, we went to a very small church, the old fashioned kind of church where you could stand up on Wednesday night and give a testimony. And I couldn't even do that without trembling and my knees knocking and my voice getting weak. And so I was still that young person. And here my pastor reached out to me and said that he wanted to encourage me to do this thing. And he was encouraging me because all of his other pastor friends had said that they thought I would be good at it. And I'm like, what are you even talking about? And so I did. And I became sort of a public speaker in a small scale. And I never, ever would have done that without someone pointing that I knew and trusted, saying, you would be good at this and you should do this. And so, you know, now that's what I do. But that was the first time that I was asked to do it. And it was because someone else saw the potential in me that I didn't see in myself.
I like that a lot. You know, when I was young meaning, you know, late teenager, I thought I wanted to be a professional actor. And I, at one point, had to make a decision whether to sort of make the leap and try to do that professionally in Southern California, you know, in LA, getting an agent, blah, 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 or serving a mission for my church. And I felt called both literally by my church, but also felt called by God to serve that mission, which I did not want to do. I wanted to go in and be an actor. What that mission did for me is it rerouted me. It made me somebody who even thought about wanting to go into sort of higher education, because I got taken with the mystery of what makes people tick, who they are, why they are as they are, what in them is individual, what in us works on us culturally, historically, socially, et cetera. And those larger questions brought me into higher ed. Now the only acting that I do is like when I'm reading, you know, a book in a class, and you kind of give more character to certain lines, you know, or whatever.
Hey, it's important.
That's right. Yeah, right. And speaking of that, of being an actor and the fatal choice from which I was actually diverted, okay, from making, I appreciate this observation in your book. I'm quoting again here. All know people serving in roles which they are so ill-fitted, that would be me as actor, that they seem to be role-playing badly at something that they wish they could do. When the calls don't come, it might be owing to any number of things. Too little need for particular talent, not yet finding the right audience from a form of art, or insufficient talent. That last one is hardest to come to grips with, you write, and agreed. But it's also crucial to recognize this, right? Because it can be a gateway to learning some other lesson, like about humility, or it's an indication not so much to renounce a sense of purpose as to readjust its scale, right? Maybe you aren't called to be a Broadway star, but you might be a really great high school drama teacher or something like this, mm-hmm. right? And I guess my question here is, how do you counsel people to reckon with their failures, not by kind of beating themselves up for the talent they lack, but for discerning what God would have them understand and find with the talents that they have?
Yeah, I mean, it really can be a redirection. I mean, because there are two losses that happen when we pursue something that we're not meant to pursue, we're not gifted to pursue. The first loss is, well, this thing that's not being done very well. Again, whether it, you know, it could be a teacher or a pastor who's just not gifted in that area and can end up doing harm because of that. But also the other loss is that when you're looking in one direction, you aren't seeing the other direction where you could have flourished and thrived and used your talents. And so it's, again, I think some of this goes back to just simply having role models in front of us that we see doing well and being successful. And we think, oh, I want to do that, or I could do that. And, you know, the reality may be that we can't. Or simply seeing, you know, sometimes it's not even about talent. It's, I mean, you know, writing is the, you know, is what I'm doing. That's my profession now. And, you know, we live in a world where writers are a dime a dozen, right? And there are so many factors involved in being successful as a writer that have almost nothing to do with the craft, sadly to say, but this is the reality of the world that we live in. And so just because you can write and want to write and do write does not mean you're going to be successful in, you know, in monetary or public ways. And so you have to reorient yourself to, like, you know, writers are people who write regardless of what the outcome is. And then also, but if you're really trying to do something that is going to make an impact and serve a need, then maybe you do, you know, we don't have limitless time and resources. And so if it really isn't serving a need, because that's what the purpose of vocation is, then we should probably put our time into something else where we can really be filling a need.
Yeah, okay, good. I think in my own case, you know, I am a writer because I'm an academic and you have to write.
Right.
But I think the course that my career has taken is very different from what I thought it was going to be when I started. If you told me 25 years ago, I'd be doing what I'm doing right now as a scholar, the things I do, I would have asked myself, I'd ask the question, wow, what happened? What got you off that track? What went wrong? You know, actually, it's a whole series of things that actually revealed, opened themselves to me because there were opportunities that I didn't even know to want when I was younger,
yes.
Right? And
yes.
That was a slow process of discernment for me to sort of get a new calling from within the career I already had. Anyway, so what you're saying, I found a list resonant. This is why I want to talk about this book, Karen. This is all about my psychology. This is all about, you know.
No, but I mean, this is such a common thing. I had the same, like, I didn't know. I loved reading from the time I could read at 5 years old and loved English in school, but I didn't come from an academic family, so I didn't even know you could, like, major in English and study it at higher levels. I didn't know. And then when I discovered it, I'm like, oh, this is what I want to do. And so it is all sort of an unfolding and an adventure. And as you referenced earlier, God will use it all. You know, there's nothing wasted in his economy, and that is so freeing and reassuring. I mean, yeah, we can make mistakes that, you know, we might have caused a lot less pain if we hadn't made. So we certainly want to avoid that, but he can still use it all and will use it all. And so I find that freeing.
Amen. Okay, so the last part of your book, sorry, reprises the great philosophical categories of truth, goodness, and beauty, right? And you apply those categories to the subject of vocation, and you say that you don't think it's possible to pursue one's calling without pursuing truth, goodness, and beauty. So my questions here are, so why is this? And what would you say to a possible kind of a response or rejoinder that to keep the discussion to that kind of high-flown philosophical level, right? Truth, goodness, beauty, mm-hmm. is to risk overlooking people in their particular circumstances. You know, for mm-hmm. you know, God, what I need, Karen, is not philosophy. I need, you know, mm-hmm. understanding of whether I should complete my college degree, or whether I should stay in a difficult marriage, or whether I'm receiving the right counsel from my faith leaders, et cetera. So in other words, how do you recommend people balance the big ideas mm-hmm. with their own unique individual circumstances?
Mm. Well, that's actually what I try to do when I talk about truth, goodness, and beauty, which are, you know, abstract philosophical ideas. But like all good philosophy, it only works if it works in the practicalities and ordinary life. And so by talking about truth, goodness, and beauty, I am actually trying to bring this higher, I think, question of calling and vocation that so many people struggle with down to the ground and say these three things, truth, goodness, and beauty, because they reflect the nature of God and because their origin is in him and their end is in him. If we are pursuing those, we will answer the big question about calling, because we will be pursuing God and his nature and character himself. And so in each of the separate chapters on the good, the true, and the beautiful, I really do bring it down to earth and say, you know, sometimes the question before us at this moment is, what is good for me to do right now? And part of that is, you know, what can I do well? How can I serve my neighbor? What are their needs? And that is pursuing goodness. Pursuing truth is doing what we've talked about throughout this conversation, is kind of recognizing reality. It's not just the moral truth, which Christians are really good at talking about moral truth, at least in the abstract, but truth also encompasses the truth of the world right now, the neighbors around me, the community I live in, the needs that are in the world now and the needs that aren't in the world right now. I mean, you know, as I said before, the world doesn't necessarily need all the writers that want to be writers or all of the YouTubers who want to be YouTubers. And so we have to know the truth about the world around us. And then with the beautiful, I take the, you know, the sort of ethereal abstract principles of beauty offered by Aquinas, which are luminosity, proportion, and integrity. You know, if you think of a painting, you think about how a masterpiece of a painting would exhibit those qualities. Well, in our own lives, if we pursue integrity, which we know what that means, which is not just honesty, but even wholeness, like bringing our whole selves to everything that we do. Proportion, giving what's due to what's due, and realizing that there are times in life when certain demands need more attention than others, and then they can reverse. And so there's a proportionality in the work that we do and the callings we have. And then my favorite is luminosity, which is a fancy kind of ethereal word, but if you think about it as just bringing light to the world, there are so many ways every day in the most ordinary, mundane situations that we can bring light to the world by offering an explanation, by offering a smile that lights up our face and someone else's face, by offering a kind word instead of an impatient word, by, you know, making the accounts balance, which isn't something I can do, but other people can, by making the sentence sing, by hammering the nail squarely. All of these are things that bring light and clarity to the world in all of the work that we do and the relationships that we have. And if we pursue those, we're pursuing our calling and fulfilling our calling.
I think you do a great job in the book of bringing the big ideas down to actual real world contexts. I thought that was actually a really lovely part of the book. You know, luminous. I'll use that word. Yeah, okay, good. One thing you do in the book, which I really appreciate, you contrast good work with perfectionism, right? Mm-hmm. And you remark that our inevitable imperfection is actually freeing, right? As we discussed in this conversation, that God can and does use us even in our imperfection. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of scriptural evidence for that, to say nothing of abundant examples in everyday life. So then my question again is this, I guess, how do you balance the baseline reality of inevitable imperfection, that's just the reality of us as mortals, with the injunction to try to become disciples and, you know, true followers of Christ? I guess I'm wondering what repentance looks like relative to our callings in light of the dual imperatives, first, to confess our weakness, but second, to try to follow Jesus.
Callings are something that come from outside of ourselves. Because
it's an invitation.
You know, as Christians, embroiled as I am,
that invitation is a divine invitation.
Willingly and unwittingly, just even through people.
In the world
that
of,
also means
of
that
so much that
it's not just entirely our choice.
It's not just entirely
for
something
example,
that we choose
you know,
to do. Although,
I don't,
do
and no one I know
answer the call
expects church life or believers to be perfect. In fact, our doctrine teaches, as you suggested, that we're not. And so repentance should be just sort of, it should be normal and expected. And instead we have cover up and excuses and denials. And I think, you know, this is sort of a different subject matter, but it's kind of the same, because this expectation that is rooted in maintaining appearances and making things look as though they are perfect or always excellent is what hinders repentance, because there's an expectation that there can be no mistakes or no falling or no need to repent and repair. And so even in our work life and our calling, this is the particular cultural moment that another one that I was responding to is because there's a whole generation or two or three that's been brought up in the church with the idea of doing big things for God or doing great things or changing the world and being, you know, just being dramatic and radical and all kinds of words. And there are people who are going to do those things, and that's fine. But most of us are going to serve God and our neighbor in ordinary, small ways every day and in good ways that don't make headlines. And so keeping our understanding of vocation and callings in the realm of the good, doing good work, I think that helps us to be more fulfilled, to have a more realistic understanding of how magnificent it is that God created us to serve one another, even in ordinary ways, and to also realize that repentance is just kind of an ongoing part of life, because it's just the way that we can become good again, I guess, by recognizing our weaknesses and our failures as individuals and, of course, as a church community.
Yeah, amen to that. That's great, Karen. And you know, the thing about it, too, is when I find, at least in my own case, and I've seen this more broadly, too, you know, when we are genuinely penitent, we really try to repent, you know, I mean, God's grace is sufficient, right? And yes. God does bear us up, and we find that we are actually better coming out of it than we would have been if we tried to sort of hide it or deny it or fail to reckon with it in some way. So I really appreciate what you say there. Let me close with a couple of questions for you. Yeah, this has been a great conversation. I'm so grateful for you, Karen, for coming on here, for writing this book in the first place and all the other books that you write. You close the book by talking about fittingness, right? Us learning to fit ourselves rightly to our callings. And I love your closing observations in the book. You write this: whatever your calling is, you have been fitted for it. The fit matters. The right fit is always beautiful. Your true calling looks beautiful on you. Now, as you've grown spiritually over the years, and as callings have both come to you and reached their end, and as you've embarked on new callings, I guess my question is, do you feel you become better at recognizing the proper fit of a calling? Are you kinder on yourself than you used to be? Are you more able to say, that calling there, that's beautiful on me?
Oh, I love that question. I think so. And I think along with that, I am coming to greater peace in, you know, in these very moments and these days in recognizing, and I don't think I said this in the book, but you're helping me to think of it in this way, is that sometimes what fit 10 years ago doesn't fit quite as well now. And that is because the world is changing, but we're also changing and maturing. And I'm learning to give myself grace for understanding that something that did fit once and doesn't fit anymore can actually help me to understand what does fit now, and to embrace that and to be grateful to God for bringing me to a better fit, as painful as that can be. I mean, the clothes analogy can go on and on, you know, as a woman of a certain age, I'm constantly, you know, trying to find the clothes that fit the right way. And so I think the same, you know, of course we don't want to shake off all of the things in our lives that, you know, every other year or so, but our callings, this goes back to the whole point that our callings do change and shift and sometimes end, but yet through the Lord's grace, we will find what we are fitted for in this time, and He will use all that we, you know, have brought along the way to make that fit.
That's great. Let me end here. What you write, Action Your Book's introduction. And I'll quote you again here. I love these thoughts here. You write, a way is a manner of going. It's the form our lives take on this worldly journey. The Christian is called to follow the way of Jesus. Jesus is the true, the good, and the beautiful. As creatures made in the image of God, we are each called to pursue truth, goodness, and beauty in all of life, Only in doing this can you discern and then follow your particular vocation, that particular work God has created you to do. Okay, I think those are beautiful reflections, and they deeply resonate with me. And this is kind of the last question I asked you, but do you find you're able to follow Jesus differently or better now than you could, say, 10 or 20 years ago?
Well, I want to hope so. It seems like it, and I think that is partly because I was more reliant on other people and institutions, which, you know, we can never be completely independent of them, and I'm not saying that, but there's something that comes with maturity and experience, even bad experiences, and the wisdom that comes along with that, that can help us to hold all those things still, but to hold them more loosely and to hold more closely to Jesus, because those other things will always disappoint us and even betray us, even as they bless us. But Jesus is just all blessing. And so I think I'm closer to him than I have been my entire life. And it's because of some of the painful things that I've gone through, but he has been faithful and steadfast. And so it's been good. He's been good.
Thank you for that testimony and for the work you do, Karen. We're grateful.
Thank you so much for this very enriching conversation.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Faith and Imagination podcast. This podcast is sponsored by the Faith and Imagination Institute, the BYU Humanities Center, and the College of Humanities at Brigham Young University, and is produced and edited by Kate Thorpe. The music for this podcast is composed by Ethan Wickman and is performed by Nicholas Phillips on Albany Records. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave us a review on your podcast platform. And if you're interested in other episodes, check out our website at humanitiescenter.byu.edu. Thanks again for listening.